Welcome to the Sutliffian Report, the place where the news is never hidden and the truth always wins. Today we are going to do a number of things, but first of all, we're going to talk about 9/11. With the 20th anniversary coming up, that's one of the things that we're going to do today. Part of this is in preparation for next week's show, where I'll have Claire Lopez, a former case officer of the CIA, who now works with United West and her own company, Lopez Liberty, LLC. We're going to talk about her co-authored federal affidavit on Iran's involvement in the Al-Qaeda plot next week. But I want to, again, get first into the Word of God, because we are a Christian show, and let's go straight to that. 1 Corinthians 3:16 to 17 says, "Know you not that you are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy. For the temple of God is holy, which temple you are." One of the problems in the lives of believers in Christ is that we as Christians are still sinners. We still do stupid things. We still seek to do that which we know displeases God. Worst of all, as believers, like I said, we do it knowingly. Whether this be an act of lust or any sin imaginable, they are actions that defile the temple of God. We are each a temple of God. We are His creation. We are the ones Jesus left the 99 sheep to find the lost one. We are that lost sheep. And Jesus found us. We are the ones who have been saved by His precious blood offered on the cross as the sacrifice for our sins. Yet we still do that which we know displeases God. We need to stop living selfishly and living for ourselves. We need to begin to live for Him and what He did for us. How do we do this? We come before Him daily. This means time in prayer, time in reading His word, and time taking those two things into action. God changes us. He does incredible, impossible things in us. But we need to give back to Him by living for Him. Dear Lord Jesus, You are the God who does impossible things. Because of that, we know we can come before You, and beg that the things that tempt us be made of no effect. Lord, help us to stand against the fiery darts of the devil through the reading of Your word. Lord, strengthen us that we might be that light shining on the hill to show others the way to You. In Jesus' name, amen. This Saturday will mark the 20th anniversary of the most horrific attack by a foreign entity on American soil. I say most horrific in that the weapons used involved the innocent lives of those on those planes. They took over 3,000 lives altogether in the span of a few hours. Today's high school students were not yet born. They have no memory of this event. College kids today don't grasp the horror of this horrible event. Only those in their late 20s, and they're the youngest, have some understanding of this day. Let's start with that question we all asked. Where were you on 9/11? If you're listening and want to share where you were on 9/11, please feel free to call in. I'm going to share where I was. And if you want to call in, that call-in number is 319-527-6706. Eric, please do call in. Thank you for joining us, Eric. I have to tell you where I was. I'm a teacher. I was teaching a class on 9/11. My neighbor next door used the Today Show as part of his teaching. He talked about current events, and he made that a predominant part of his class. We were social studies teachers. We were special education social studies teachers, and we did incredible work with these students. I still remember seeing him come into the room and say, "Paul, a plane just flew into the World Trade Center. It's horrible. It's got to have been something like United or American or Delta. They didn't know what plane it was. They saw the plane fly in. We listened to the speculation that it might have been a private plane, but that was not what, when they replayed the tape, that's not what it looked like. And my friend who was in that next room, his name was Carl. Carl was a Vietnam vet, and we had talked a lot about that, and he had two young boys. And as the second plane hit, I was back in my room, and he came in. There were tears in his eyes and fear, and I saw it. I understood why he was shaking more than any other person in that room, because that was the first thing that told us we were at war. I almost cry thinking about this event. I watched the fear in his eyes, and I knew a lot of why it was there. He'd seen one war, but his boys were of that age that they would sign up, and they did. They joined the military. They went over and fought for this country. That was one horrific day. We didn't know who attacked us. We didn't know anything about it, except for that it had happened. And we would have to wait to find out who attacked us. It was a horrible day. There were no Democrats on that day. There were no Democrats. There were no Republicans. It was just us. It was just us. And what did we want to do that day? Point blank, I'm going to put it as blunt as I can, and I don't normally cuss, and if you consider this cussing, I'm sorry. All we wanted to do that day was kick ass. That's all we wanted to do. We wanted revenge. We wanted it now. We didn't want it later. We wanted it immediately. And that's how we felt, knowing that we were at war. And the pain that was in our heart, knowing that some of us had lost loved ones. Now, I live in New York State, and I live in the western part of the state. That was in New York City. It was in D.C. It was in Pennsylvania. There were four planes that day that went down. There was speculation that there was to be more. We heard about each plane. We saw the two go down. We heard about a plane heading towards D.C., and then the Pentagon was hit. It was quick. It was speculation. There was no knowledge of what exactly was happening, and it was so quick that it was all we could do to sit there wondering if they were going to kill us all day with planes from the sky. It was scary. And kids today cannot grasp this fear, this feeling of dread. They can't. It hurts. They weren't born yet, as I said earlier. They have no comprehension of seeing these towers fall. They could watch it in videotape. It's another thing to see that live It's another thing to be there watching the horror of the event. I have friends who were there in New York City. I have friends that were all over the world. And we all will say, where were you on that day? Now, again, if you wanted to call in and share, this is the perfect time to do that. In light of that, I'm going to play the song I usually end the show with, because I think about 9/11 and I think about how we felt on that day. And Toby Keith had summed it up, and that's many reasons why I play that song at the end of my show every day. But because we are talking about 9/11, I'm going to play that and give people a chance to call in. If they don't, we'll stop the music. Again, that call-in number is 319-527-6706. Press 1 if you want to talk. Again, it's 319-527-6706. I need to take a quick breath from sharing that information.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see your glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. As soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down. Brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
Now I have Eric joining us. All right. Thank you, Eric, for joining us. So where were you?
How are you tonight?
Pretty good. Hi, Eric. Thank you for joining us. Where were you on 9/11?
I was at work. I was in the Army. It was in the middle of the week, wasn't it? It was like on a Monday or Tuesday. It seemed like it was. Anyway.
It feels like it was a Monday, because it made the whole week waited. I don't know, I have a better
description. It changed everything. I mean, I was standing out in front of the place where I was working. I was, I hate to admit this, I was smoking a cigarette is what I was doing. I used to smoke then. I was talking to somebody, and some soldier comes up and he says, "Hey, Sergeant, Dad, did you hear what just happened this morning?" I'm like, "What?" And he says, an airplane flew into one of the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. And I, you know, it's embarrassing to admit this, because I thought maybe it was like Helen Keller or Stevie Wonder out there driving a plane around and we got lost in the fog or something and ran into the building. And my response was, "Well, whoops, hate it when that happens." Well, I went inside, and my boss, who's the Sergeant Major at the time, I went into his office to check and see if he knew, and he had the television on in his office. And just as I glanced at the screen, that's when that second plane hit. And, you know, you saw it, you know, live on TV. You know, you couldn't, you didn't, you know, when I went in there, I didn't understand what was going on. But when I saw that second plane hit, we knew. I mean, we just both looked at each other, and we just knew that, you know, it's game on. We're going someplace. We're going to get deployed. And I was in a division that was, you know, very highly deployable. And then, of course, as the day got worse, we find out that the Pentagon got hit, and that plane crashed out in Pennsylvania. You know, we knew that it was we were going someplace, and the whole installation, it hardened up right away. People, they were searching every vehicle coming on the post. It took me, I would say, probably about 3 hours just to get off the installation to come home, just to get off the installation. And it was probably 300 yards from where I worked to the gate of the installation. It was that tight. And the entire Army, the entire country, you know, everything changed that day. And we knew it. And when we got home, my wife, of course, she's in tears because she knows, you know, she knows what's going to happen. And it was, you know, thankfully, I did not deploy with that initial bunch going into Afghanistan. Well, I don't say thankfully, but I didn't. I finally deployed in February of, 2003, in the run-up to Iraq is where I was involved in it.
You said, you talked about that feeling of, I mean, we watched that happen. It still makes me cry when I think about it.
Oh, yeah. Heavens, yeah. You're sitting there watching. Yeah, you're watching this live on TV, and you're watching people jump out of those buildings.
Yeah, that's what I was
trying to say. When I taught this in my classes, you know, you're pleading with the kids, please try to understand. This was live on national TV. The whole country watched in horror as people are jumping out of these towers. They watched in horror as these buildings came down on our police officers, on our firemen. And we knew hundreds of people were still in those buildings. We didn't realize that, you know, it would be up in the thousands, but we knew it was definitely the hundreds. And to watch those people, you know, hanging out those windows, begging for somebody to come help them, you're right. It just tears your guts out. You know, looking back and remembering those feelings that you had that morning.
Yeah, I think, I've showed it to my students in they ask, why are they jumping out? I mean, there's no way they can live. I said they had to make a choice. Be burned alive or jump. Which would you choose? I mean, there's a possible miracle if you jump. Not much of one. And that was the stuff that started to make my students think, but it was a horrible day.
Yeah.
The thing that bothered me the most is my kids were immediately saying, why didn't they send planes to shoot them down? And I'm going to get into that. I'm going to read part of the 9/11 commission report, but they kept asking, well, They watch these videos that exist on YouTube and a few other places that say it was an American plot, that this was all there. And there's a lot of misinformation out there. And I try to explain
that. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have that. Yeah, I have that imam out of Houston, Texas, that is always after me, still after me, I guess. But anyway, he's one of these 9/11 truthers that, you know, actually believes that it was, you know, some type of conspiracy, some type of inside job, you know, and to think that, at, you know, in light of you know, all the evidence that we have to the contrary is just, it's just about as dumb as the day is long. And you have to be desperate to believe that.
There is a truth behind some of this. Now, here's the truth that I'm going to share that those children don't know. And this mom probably does. These conspiracy thoughts originated in the Middle East, in Arabic countries. We know that because the week before they made it here, they were being played on memory.org. A week before you heard them from any American source, they were being played on memory.org. It was there. I was listening to them, and then I started to hear it here, and I thought, isn't that interesting? I wonder who they're communicating with. All I know is, as a teacher, and hi, Alaskan, we're asking the question if you're willing to join us. Again, that phone number is 319-527-6706. Where were you on 9/11 if you'd like to join us? Just press 1 if you dial in. Let us know you're interested. I, as an educator, I strive to make my children understand concepts like this. And, you know, I've come to the conclusion as much as I want, I can't get them to understand that. Because there's one thing about experiencing something live. It's another thing to watch it on a video, especially with our children today, because they play so many video games that are violent. Concepts like this are almost lost on them, which is hurtful and sad. I think about the question they asked, though, why wasn't it stopped? So I put the question to my students. Okay, you're the president of the United States. You have had one plane fly into the World Trade Center. Or exactly as you think it's possibly a prop plane. Then you learn it's a United Airlines plane. You're asking yourself, well, what was the driver drunk? I mean, what was the pilot insane? I mean, you're asking all these questions. You learn about the second plane hitting. And, you're now being informed there's multiple planes in the air that have been hijacked. You scramble your planes. Can you give that order to shoot 100 people out of the air? Could you do that not knowing if they were really going to be used as a weapon? None of my students could answer yes when I said that to them.
Ready.
And they shut their mouths. I would not have wanted to be president that day because I don't know if I would have made that mistake. I have nothing to say on that because it's a job I would not have wanted. It's just sad no matter how I look at it. I guess someone else wants to join us. Eric, I'm going to read from the 9/11 report. And the reason I'm doing this. Yeah.
Paul, I'm gonna go ahead and run. I'm gonna jump off.
All right, thank you.
My wife are going out to we're going out for a run, and I'll listen.
Okay.
While I'm running.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. All right. I want to read from the 9/11 report, and the reason I want to read from this, and not play some video tape. The number one reason I want to read from this. Annie's joining. Annie. I was just asking if anybody wanted to join us and say where they were on 9/11. Feel free to do that. I'm going to read from the 9/11 Commission report, and the reason I want to do that call-in number, if you're not aware, is 319-527-6706, and press 1 if you want to talk. The reason I want to read the 9/11 report is because of the order, how they put these events in order. It kind of explains why very little was done. It's, again, it's a report. It may not be the best description, but because it was done in this format, it probably is the best description I can find. Now, again, why am I doing this today? Next week, I have Claire Lopez joining us to talk about the Iranian involvement in 9/11. And I feel that we must first set that up. We must talk about this horrible day. We'll bring tears to your eyes. I know it does to mine whenever I talk about it. So please forgive me if I'm not as animated today. It's a hard thing to talk about. And when we're talking about 9/11, we are talking about the deaths of thousands. Almost none of them were soldiers. That's something to think about. In Pearl Harbor, the Japanese flew over all the non-military sites and bombed the Navy site. This was a first attack on our soil against non-military people. It was the second Al-Qaeda attack on the World Trade Center. We're going to talk a little bit more about that as time goes on. The second attack. Keep that in mind. So I'm going to get into this 9/11 attack. This is Paul. Eric had to go off. Okay, so here we go. This is starting from page one. There's a reason I'm doing this, so please bear with me. Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, dawn temperature and nearly cloudless in the eastern United States, millions of men and women readied themselves for work. Some made their way to the Twin Towers, the signature structure of the World Trade Center complex in New York City. Others went to Arlington, Virginia, to the Pentagon, across the Potomac River, and the United States Congress was back in session. At the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, people began to line up for a White House tour. In Sarasota, Florida, President George W. Bush went for an early morning run. For those heading to an airport, weather conditions could not have been better for a safe and pleasant journey. Among the travelers were Muhammad Atta, Abdulaziz Al-Mari, who arrived at the airport in Portland, Maine. Boarding the flights, Boston, American 11 and United 175. Atta and Al-Mari boarded at 6 a.m. flight from Portland to Boston's Logan International Airport. When he checked in for his flight to Boston, Atta was selected by a computerized pre-screening system known as CAPS, Computer-Assisted Passenger Pre-Screening System, created to identify passengers who should be subject to special security measures. Under security rules in place at the time, the only consequence of ADA selection by CAPS was that his checked bags were held off the plane until it was confirmed that he had boarded the aircraft. This did not hinder ADA's plans. ADA and Al-Mari arrived in Boston at 6:45. 7 minutes later, ADA apparently took a call from Marwan Al-Shahi, a longtime colleague, was at another terminal at Logan Airport. They spoke for 3 minutes. It would be their final conversation. Between 6:45 and 7:40, Anna and Al-Mari, along with Satam Al-Sukami, Wail Al-Shahiri, and Waleed Al-Shahiri, checked in and boarded American Airlines Flight 11 for Los Angeles. The flight was scheduled to depart at 7:45. In another Logan terminal, Shahi, joined by Fayez Banahamid, Mohand al-Shahri and Ahmad al-Ghamdi and Al-Hamza al-Ghamdi checked in United Airlines Flight 175, also bound for Los Angeles. A couple of Shahi's colleagues were obviously unused to travel, according to the United Ticket agent. They had trouble understanding the standard security questions, and she had to go over them slowly until they gave the routine reassuring answers. Their flight was scheduled to depart at 8 o'clock. The security checkpoints through which the passengers, including Atta and his colleagues, gained access to American 11 gate were operated by Globe Security under a contract with American Airlines. In a different terminal, the single checkpoint through which the passengers for United 175 passed was controlled by United Airlines, which had contracted with Huntley USA to perform the screening. In passing through these checkpoints, each of the hijackers would have been screened by a walk-through metal detector calibrated to detect items with at least the metal content of a .22 caliber handgun. Anyone who might have set off that detector would have been screened with a hand one, a procedure requiring the screener to identify the metal item or items that caused the alarm. In addition, an X-ray machine would have screened the hijackers' carry-on belongings. The screening was in place to identify and confiscate weapons and other items that from being prohibited from carrying on to commercial flights. None of the checkpoint supervisors recalled the hijackers or reported anything suspicious regarding their screening. While ADA had been selected by CAPS in Portland, three members of his hijacking team, Sukami, Wail al-Shahri, and Waleed al-Shahri, were selected in Boston. Their selection affected only the handling of their checked bags, not their screening at the checkpoint. All five men cleared the checkpoint and made their way to the gate for American 11. Ada, Omari, and Sukami took their seats in business class, seats 8D, 8G, and 10B, respectively. The Shahri brothers had adjacent seats in row 2, Whale in 2A, Waleed in 2B, in the first-class cabin. They boarded American 11 between 7:31 and 7:40. The aircraft pushed back from the gate at 7:40. Shahi and his team, none of whom had been selected by CAPS, boarded United 175 between 7:23 and 7:28. Bani Hamid in 2A, Shahri in 2B, Shahi in 6C, Hamza al-Ghamdi in 9C, and Ahmed al-Ghamdi in 9D. Their aircraft pushed back from the gate just before 8 o'clock. Washington Dulles, American 77. Hundreds of miles southwest of Boston at Dulles International Airport and the Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C., five more men were preparing to take the early morning flight at 7:15. A pair of them, Khalid Midhar and Majed Moked, checked in at the American Airlines ticket counter for Flight 77, bound for Los Angeles. Within the next 20 minutes, they would be followed by Hani Hanjour and two brothers, Nawaf al-Hamzi and Salim al-Hazmi. Hani Hanjour, Khalid al-Midhar, and Majed Moked were flagged by CAPS. The Hazmi brothers were also selected for extra screening by the airline's security customer representative at the check-in counter. He did so because one of the brothers did not have photo ID and could not understand English, and because the agent found both of the passengers to be suspicious. The only consequence of their selection was that their checked bags were held off the plane until it was confirmed that they had boarded the aircraft. All five hijackers passed through the main terminal's west security screening point. United Airlines, which was the responsible air carrier, had contracted out the work to Argent Bright Security. The checkpoint featured closed-circuit television that recorded all passengers, including the hijackers, as they were screened. At 7:18, Midhar and Moked entered the security checkpoint. Midhar and Moked placed their carry-on bags on the belt of the X-ray machine and proceeded through the first metal detector both set off the alarm, and they were directed to a second metal detector. Midhar did not trigger the alarm and was permitted through the checkpoint. After Moked set it off, our screener bonded him. He passed for inspection. About 20 minutes later, at 7:35, another passenger for Flight 77, Hani Hanjour, placed two carry-on bags on the X-ray belt in the main terminal's west checkpoint and proceeded without alarm through the metal detector. A short time later, Nawaf and Salim Al-Hazmi entered the same checkpoint. Salim Al-Hazmi cleared the metal detector and was permitted through. Nawaf Al-Hazmi and wanded before being passed. In addition, his over-the-shoulder carry-on bag was swiped by an electronic trace detector and then passed. The video footage indicated that he was carrying an unidentified item in the back pocket, clipped to its rim. When the local civil aviation security office of the Federal Aviation Administration later investigated these security screening operations, the screeners recalled nothing out of the ordinary. They could not recall that any of the passengers they screened were CAP selectees. We asked a screening expert to review the videotape of the hand wanding, and he found the quality of the screener's work to have been marginal at best. The screener should have resolved what set off the alarm. And in the case of both Moked and Hazmi, it was clear that he did not. At 7:50, Majid Moked and Khalid Al-Midhar boarded the flight and were seated in 12A and 12B in coach. Hani Hanjour, assigned to seat 1B first class, soon followed. The Hazmi brothers, sitting in 5E and 5F, joined Hanjour in the first class cabin. Newark, United 93. Between 7:03 and 7:39, Saeed Al-Ghamdi, Ahmed Al-Nami, Ahmad Al-Haznawi, and Ziad Jar checked in at the United Airlines ticket counter for Flight 93, going to Los Angeles. Two checked bags, two did not. Hazmi was selected by CAPS. His check bag was screened for explosives and then loaded on the plane. The four men passed through a security checkpoint owned by United Airlines and operated under contract by Argonaut Bright Security, like the checkpoints in Boston. It lacked closed-circuit television surveillance, so there is no documentary evidence to indicate when the hijackers passed through the checkpoint, what alarms may have been triggered, or what security procedures were administered. The FAA interviewed the screeners later. None recalled anything unusual or suspicious. The four men boarded the plane between 7:39 and 7:48. All four had seats in the first-class cabin. Their plane had no business class section. Jar was in seat 1B closest to the cockpit. Nami was in 3C, Ghamdi in 3D, Hazmi in 6B. The 19 men were aboard four transcontinental flights. They were planning to hijack these planes and turn them into large guided missiles loaded with up to 11,400 gallons of jet fuel. By 8 a.m. on the morning of Tuesday, September 11, 2001, they had defeated all the security layers that America's civil aviation security system then had in place to prevent a hijacking. The hijacking of American 11. American Airlines Flight 11 provided nonstop service from Boston to Los Angeles. On September 11, Captain John Agonowski and First Officer Thomas McGinnis piloted the Boeing 767. It carried its full capacity of 9 flight attendants. 81 passengers aboard the flight with them included the 5 terrorists. The plane took off at 7:59, just before 8:15, and climbed to 26,000 feet, not quite its initial assigned cruising altitude of 29,000 feet. all communications and flight profile data were normal. About this time, the fasten seatbelt signs would usually have been turned off, and the flight attendants would have begun preparing for cabin service. At that time, American 11 had its last routine communication with the ground when it acknowledged navigational instructions from FAA's Air Traffic Control Center in Boston. 16 seconds after that transmission, ATC instructed the aircraft pilots to climb to 35,000. That message and all subsequent attempts to contact the flight were not acknowledged. From this and other evidence, we believe the hijacking began at 8:14 or shortly thereafter. Reports from two flight attendants in the coach cabin, Betsy Ong and Madeline Amy Sweeney, told us most of what we need to know about how the hijacking happened. As it began, some of the hijackers, most likely Wael al-Shahri and Waleed al-Shahri, who were seated in row two in first class, stabbed the two unarmed flight attendants who would have been preparing for cabin service. We do not know exactly how the hijackers gained access to the cockpit. FAA rules required the doors remain closed and locked during the flight. Ong speculated that they had jammed their way in. Perhaps the terrorism stabbed the flight attendant to get a cockpit key to force one of them to open the cockpit door, or to lure the captain or first officer out of the cockpit. Or the flight attendants may just have been in their way. At the same time, or shortly thereafter, added the only terrorist on board trained to fly a jet would have moved to the cockpit from his business class seat, possibly accompanied by Omari. As this was happening, passenger Daniel Lewin, who was seated in the row just behind Ada and Omari, was stabbed by one of the hijackers, probably Satam al-Sukami, who was seated directly behind Lewin. Lewin had served 4 years as an officer in the Israeli military. He may have made an attempt to stop the hijackers in front of him, not realizing that another was sitting behind him. The hijackers quickly gained control and sprayed mace, pepper spray, or some other irritant in the first-class cabin in order to force the passengers and some flight attendants towards the rear of the plane. They claimed they had a bomb. After 5 minutes of the hijacking began, Betty Ong contacted the American Airlines Southeast Reservations Office in Cary, North Carolina, via an AT&T airphone to report an emergency aboard the flight. This was the first of several occasions on 9/11 when flight attendants took action outside the scope of their training, which emphasized that in a hijacking, they were to communicate with the cockpit crew. The emergency call lasted apparently 25 minutes. As Ong calmly and professionally relayed information about events taking place aboard the airplane to authorities on the ground. At 8:19, Ong reported, "The cockpit is not answering. Somebody stabbed in business class. I think there's mace. That we can't breathe. I don't know. I think we're getting hijacked." She then told of the stabbings of the two flight attendants. At 8:21, one of the American employees receiving Ong's call in North Carolina, Nadia Gonzalez, asked the American Airlines Operations Center in Fort Worth, Texas, reaching Craig Marquis, the manager on duty. Marquis soon realized that this was an emergency and instructed the airline's dispatcher responsible for the flight to contact the cockpit. At 8:23, dispatcher tried unsuccessfully to contact the aircraft. 6 minutes later, the air traffic control specialist in American's operations center contacted the FAA Boston Air Traffic Control Center about the flight. The center was already aware of the problem. Boston Center knew of a problem on the flight in part because just before 8:25, the hijackers had attempted to communicate with the passengers. The microphone was keyed, and immediately one of the hijackers said, "Nobody move. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any moves, you'll endanger yourself and the plane. Just stay quiet." Air traffic controllers heard the transmission. Ong did not. The hijackers, probably did not know how to operate the cockpit radio communication system correctly, and thus inadvertently broadcast their message over the air traffic control channel instead of this cabin public address channel. Also at 8:25 and again at 8:29, Amy Sweeney got through the American Flight Service office in Boston, but was cut off after she reported someone was hurt aboard the plane. 3 minutes later, Sleedy was reconnected to the office and began relaying updates to the manager, Michael Woodward. At 8:29, Ong responded that the plane was flying erratically. A minute later, Flight 11 turned south. American also began getting identifications of the hijackers. As Ong and then Sweeney passed on some of the seat numbers of those who had gained unauthorized access to the cockpit. Sweeney calmly reported on her line that the plane had been hijacked, a man in first class had his throat slashed, two flight attendants had been stabbed, one was seriously wounded and was on oxygen while the other's wounds seemed minor. A doctor had been requested. The flight attendants were unable to contact the cockpit, and there was a bomb in the cockpit. Sweeney told Woodward that she and Ong were trying to relay as much information as they could to people on the ground. At 8:38, Ong told Gonzalez that the plane was flying erratically again. Around this time, Sweeney told Woodward that the hijackers were Middle Easterners, naming three of their seat numbers. One spoke very little English and one spoke excellent English. The hijackers had gained entry to the cockpit, and she did not know how. The aircraft was in rapid descent. At 8:41, Sweeney told Woodward that passengers and coach were under the impression that there was a routine medical emergency in first class. Other flight attendants were busy at duty, such as getting medical supplies, while Ong and Sweeney were reporting the events. At 8:41 in American's operations center, a colleague told Marquise that the air traffic controllers declared Flight 11 a hijacking, thinks he's, American 11, headed towards Kennedy Airport in New York City. They're moving everybody out of the way. They seem to have him on a primary radar. They seem to think that he's descending. At 8:44, Gonzalez reported losing phone contact with Ong. About the same time, Sweeney reported to Woodward, "Something is wrong. We are in rapid descent. We are all over the place." Woodward and Sweeney to look out the window to see if they could determine where they were. Sweeney responded, "We are flying low. We are flying very, very low. We are flying way too low." Seconds later, she said, "Oh my God, we are way too low." The phone call ended. At 8:46 and 40 seconds, American 11 crashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York City. All on board, along with the unknown number of people in the tower, were killed instantly. The hijacking of United 175. United Airlines Flight 175 was scheduled to depart for Los Angeles at 8 o'clock. Captain Victor Saracini and First Officer Michael Horrox piloted the Boeing 767, which had seven flight attendants. 56 passengers boarded the flight. United 175 pushed back from its gate at 7:58, departed Logan Airport at 8:15. By 8:33, it had reached its assigned cruising altitude of 31,000 feet. The flight attendants should have begun their cabin service. The flight had taken off just as American 11 was being hijacked. And at 8:42, the United 175 flight crew completed their report on a suspicious transmission overheard from another plane, which turned out to have been Flight 11. Just after takeoff, this was United 175's last communication with the ground. The hijackers attacked sometime between 8:42 and 8:46. They used knives as reported by the two passengers and a flight attendant. Mace reported by one passenger and the threat of a bomb reported by the same passenger. They stabbed members of the flight crew reported by a flight attendant and one passenger. Both pilots had been killed, reported by one flight attendant. The eyewitness accounts came from calls made from the rear of the plane, from passengers originally seated further forward in the cabin, a sign that passengers and perhaps crew had been moved to the back of the aircraft. Given similarities to American 11 and hijacker screen seating and in eyewitness reports of tactics and weapons, as well as contact between the presumed team leaders, Ada and Shahi, we believe the tactics were similar on both flights. The first operational evidence that something was abnormal on United 175 came at 8:47. When the aircraft changed beacon codes twice within a minute. At 8:51, the flight deviated from its assigned altitude. And a minute later, New York's air traffic controllers began repeatedly and unsuccessfully trying to contact it. At 8:52 in eastern Connecticut, a man named Lee Hansen received a phone call from his son Peter, a passenger on United 175. His son told him, "I think they've taken over the cockpit. An attendant has been stabbed. And someone else up front may have been killed. The plane is making strange moves. Call United Airlines. Tell them it's flight 175, Boston to L.A. Lee Hansen then called the Easton Police Department and relayed what he had heard. Also at 8:52, a male flight attendant called a United office in San Francisco, reaching Mark Policastro. The flight attendant reported that the flight had been hijacked. Both pilots had been killed. The flight attendant had been stabbed. And the hijackers were probably flying the plane. Call lasted about 2 minutes, after which Palcasto and a colleague tried unsuccessfully to contact the flight. At 8:58, the flight took a heading towards New York City. At 8:59, flight 175 passenger Brian David Sweeney tried to call his wife, Julie. He left a message on their home answering machine that the plane had been hijacked. He then called his mother, Louise Sweeney, told her the flight had been hijacked and added the passengers were thinking about storming the cockpit to take control of the pilot of the plane away from the hijackers. At 9 o'clock, Lee Hansen received a second call from his son, Peter. "It's getting bad, Dad. A stewardess was stabbed. They seem to have knives and mace. They said they have a bomb. It's getting very bad on the plane. Passengers are throwing up and getting sick. The plane is making jerky movements. I don't think the pilot is flying the plane. I think we are going down. I think they intended to go to Chicago or someplace else and fly into a building. Don't worry, Dad, if it happens. It'll be very fast. My God, my God." The call ended abruptly. Lee Hansen had heard a woman scream just before it cut off. He turned on a television and in her home, so did Louise Sweeney. Both of them saw the second aircraft hit the World Trade Center. At 9:03 and 11 seconds, United Airlines Flight 175 struck the South Tower of the World Trade Center. All on board, along with an unknown number of people in the tower, were killed instantly. I need a little break. I know it's going to be this hard to read this, but I'm going to play that Percy Red White Blue one more time. Let me gather my thoughts to continue this.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see your glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads.
My daddy served in the army. lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
I'm back. I just needed a second to gather my thoughts. I'm sorry. This is hard to share. I just think it's important to hear this as we remember that horrible day. I don't like the term anniversary with this horrorversary, catastrophe. Terrorversary. I don't know what to call it. Because anniversaries are things that you celebrate and you laud. You look forward to the next one. This is not something we look forward to remembering. But we should never, never forget. Now, I had said at the beginning of this show, I want us to think about, have we learned anything? As you continue to listen, as I go on, keep asking yourself that. Have we learned anything? Have we learned the lessons we need to? I say to you, my thoughts are no. Some of us patriots have. Some of us are late awakened patriots. I put myself there. With that said, I'm going to continue. The hijacking of American 77. American Airlines Flight 77 was scheduled to depart from Washington Dulles for Los Angeles at 8:10. The aircraft was a Boeing 757 piloted by Captain Charles Burlingame and First Officer David Charlevoix. There were four flight attendants on September 11. The flight carried 58 passengers. American 77 pushed back from its gate at 8:09 and took off at 8:20. At 8:46, the flight reached its assigned cruising altitude of 35,000 feet. Cabin service would have begun at 8:51. American 77 transmitted its last routine communication. The hijacking began between 8:51 and 8:54. As on American 11 and United 175, the hijackers used knives, reported by one passenger, and moved all the passengers and crew to the rear of the aircraft, reported by one flight attendant and one passenger. Unlike the earlier flights, the Flight 77 hijackers reported by a passenger to have box cutters. Finally, a passenger reported that an announcement had been made by the pilot that the plane had been hijacked. Neither of the first-hand accounts mentioned any stabbings or the threat of use of either a bomb or mace, though both witnesses began the flight in the first-class cabin. At 8:54, the aircraft deviated from its assigned course, turning south. 2 minutes later, the transponder was turned off and even primary radar contact with the aircraft was lost. The Indianapolis Air Traffic Control Center was repeatedly trying and failing to contact the aircraft. American Airlines dispatchers also tried without success. At 9 o'clock, American Airlines Executive Vice President Gerard Arpey learned that communications had been lost with American 77. This was now the second American aircraft in trouble. He ordered all American Airlines flights in the Northeast that had not taken off to remain on the ground shortly before 9:10, suspecting that American 77 had been hijacked. American headquarters concluded that the second aircraft to hit the World Trade Center might have been Flight 77. After learning United Airlines was missing a plane, American Airlines headquarters extended the ground stop nationwide. At 9:12, Renee May called her mother, Nancy May, in Las Vegas. She said her flight was being hijacked by six individuals who had moved them to the rear of the plane. She asked her mother to alert American Airlines. Nancy May and her husband promptly did so. At some point between 9:16 and 9:26, Barbara Olson called her husband, Ted Olson, the Solicitor General of the United States. She reported that the flight had been hijacked and the hijackers had knives and box cutters. She further indicated the hijackers were not aware of her phone call and that they had put all the passengers in the back of the plane. About a minute into the conversation, the call was cut off. Solicitor General Olson tried unsuccessfully to reach Attorney General John Ashcroft. Shortly after the first call, Barbara Olson reached her husband again. She reported that the pilot had announced that the flight had been hijacked, and she asked her husband what she should tell the captain to do. Ted Olson asked for her location, and she replied that the aircraft was then flying over houses. Another passenger told her they were traveling northeast. The Solicitor General then informed his wife of the two previous hijackings and crashes. She did not display signs of panic and did not indicate any awareness of an impending crash. At that point, the second call was cut off. At 9:29, the autopilot on American 77 was disengaged. The aircraft was at 7,000 feet and approximately 38 miles west of the Pentagon. At 9:32, controllers of the Dulles Terminal Radar Approach Control observed a primary radar target tracking eastbound at a high rate of speed. This was later determined to have been Flight 77. At 9:34, Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport advised the Secret Service of an unknown aircraft heading in the direction of the White House. American 77 was then 5 miles west-southwest of the Pentagon and began a 330-degree turn. At the end of the turn, it was descending through 2,200 feet, pointed towards the Pentagon and downtown Washington. The hijacker pilot then advanced the throttles to maximum power and dove towards the Pentagon. At 9:37 in 46 seconds, American Airlines Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon, traveling at approximately 530 miles per hour. All on board, as well as many civilian and military personnel in the building, in that part of the building, were killed. The battle for United 93. At 8:42, United Airlines Flight 93 took off from Newark, New Jersey, Liberty International Airport, bound for San Francisco. The aircraft was piloted by Captain Jason Dahl and First Officer Leroy Homer, and there were five flight attendants, 37 passengers, including the hijackers, boarded the plane. Scheduled to depart the gate at 8 o'clock and Boeing 757 takeoff was delayed because of the airport's typically heavy morning traffic. The hijackers had planned to take flights scheduled to depart at 7:45, American 11, 8 o'clock, United 175 and United 93, and 8:10, American 77. Three of the flights had actually taken off within 10 to 15 minutes of the planned departure times. 993 would ordinarily have taken off about 15 minutes after pulling away from the gate. When it left the ground at 8:42, the flight was running more than 25 minutes late. At United 93, left Newark, the flight crew members were unaware of the hijacking of American 11. At around 9 o'clock, the FAA, American, and United were facing the staggering realization of apparent multiple hijackings. At 9:03, they would see another aircraft strike the World Trade Center. Crisis managers at the FAA and the airlines did not yet act to warn other aircraft. At the same time, Boston Center realized that a message transmitted just before 8:25 by the hijacker pilot of American 11 included the phrase, "We have some planes." No one at the FAA or the airlines that day had ever dealt with multiple hijackings. Such a plot had not been carried out anywhere in the world in more than 30 years, and never in the United States. As news of the hijackings filtered through the FAA and the airlines, it does not seem to have occurred to their leadership that they need to alert other aircraft in the air that they, too, might be at risk. United 175 was hijacked between 8:42 and 8:46, and awareness of that hijacking began to spread after 8:51. American 77 was hijacked between 8:51 and 8:54. By 9 o'clock, FAA and airline officials began to comprehend that attackers were going after multiple aircraft. American Airlines nationwide ground stop between 9:05 and 9:10 was followed by United Airlines ground stop. FAA controllers at Boston Center, which had tracked the first two hijackings, requested 9:07. At Herndon Command Center, get messages to airborne to increase the security for the cockpit. There is no evidence that Herndon took such an action. Boston Center immediately began speculating about other aircraft that might be in danger, leading them to worry about a transcontinental flight, Delta 1989, that in fact was not hijacked. At 9:19, the FAA's New England regional office called Herndon and asked the Cleveland Center advise Delta 1989 to use extra cockpit security. Several FAA air traffic control officials told us it was the air carrier's responsibility to notify their planes of security problems. One senior FAA air traffic control manager said that it was simply not the FAA's place to order the airlines what to tell their pilots. We believe such statements do not reflect an adequate appreciation of the FAA's responsibility for the safety and security of civil aviation. That was a conclusion by the 9/11 Commission report. The airlines bore responsibility too. They were facing an escalating number of conflicting and, for the most part, erroneous reports about other flights, as well as continuing lack of vital information from the FAA about the hijacked flights. We found no evidence, however, that the American Airlines sent any cockpit warnings to its aircraft on 9/11. United's first decisive action to notify its airborne aircraft to take defensive action did not come until 9:19, when United flight dispatcher Ed Bellinger took the initiative to begin transmitting warnings to his 16 transcontinental flights. Beware any cockpit intrusion. Two AC aircraft hit World Trade Center. One of the flights that received the warning was United 93. Bollinger was still responsible for his other flights as well as Flight 175. His warning message was not transmitted to Flight 93 until 9:23. By all accounts, the first 46 minutes of Flight 93's cross-country trip proceeded routinely. Radio communication from the plane were normal. Heading, speed, and altitude ran according to plan. At 9:24, Bellinger's warning to United 93 was received in the cockpit. Within 2 minutes at 9:26, the pilot, Jason Dahl, responded with a note of puzzlement. "Ed, confirm latest message, please, Jason. The hijackers attacked at 9:28. While traveling 35,000 feet above eastern Ohio, United 93 suddenly dropped 700 feet. 11 seconds into the descent, the FAA's Air Traffic Control Center in Cleveland received the first of two radio transmissions from the aircraft. During the first broadcast, the captain or first officer could be heard declaring, "Mayday," amid the sounds of a physical struggle in the cockpit. The sound, second radio transmission, 35 seconds later, indicated the flight was continuing. The captain or first officer could be heard shouting, "Hey, get out of here, get out of here, get out of here." On the morning of 9/11, there were only 37 passengers on United 93, 33 in addition to the four hijackers. This was below the norm for Tuesday morning during the summer of 2001, but there is no evidence that the hijackers manipulated passenger levels or purchased additional seats to facilitate their operation. The terrorists who hijacked three other commercial flights on 9/11 operated in five-man teams. They initiated their cockpit takeover within 30 minutes of takeoff. On Flight 93, however, the takeoff took place 46 minutes after takeoff, and there were only four hijackers. The operative likely intended to round out the team for this flight, Mohammed Al-Qahtani, had been refused entry by a suspicious immigration inspector at Florida Orlando's International Airport in August. Because several passengers in United 93 described three hijackers on the plane, not four, some have wondered whether one of the hijackers had been able to use the cockpit jump seat from the outset of the flight. FAA rules allow use of a seat by documented and approved individuals, usually air carrier or FAA personnel. We have found no evidence indicating that one of the hijackers or anyone else sat there on the flight. All the hijackers had assigned seats in first class. They seem to have used them. We believe it is more likely that Jara, the crucial pilot train member of this team, remained seated and inconspicuous until after the cockpit was seized. And once inside, he would not have been visible to the passengers. At 9:32, a hijacker, probably Jara, made an attempt to making the following announcement to the passenger of Flight 93. "Ladies and gentlemen, here, the captain, please sit down. Keep remaining sitting. We have bomb on board, so sit." The flight data recorder also indicates that Jara then instructed the plane's autopilot to turn the aircraft around and head east. The cockpit voice recorder data indicated that a woman, most likely a flight attendant, was being held captive in the cockpit. She struggled with one of the hijackers who killed or otherwise silenced her. Shortly thereafter, the passengers and flight crew began a series of calls from the GTE smartphones, earphones, and cellular phones. These calls between family, friends, and colleagues took place until the end of the flight and provided those on the ground with firsthand accounts. They enabled the passengers to gain critical information, including the news that two aircraft had slammed into the World Trade Center. At 9:39, the FAA's Cleveland Air Route Traffic Control Center overheard a second announcement indicating that there was a bomb on board, that the plane was returning to the airport, and that they should remain seated. Apparently was not heard by the passengers, this announcement, like those in Flight 11 and Flight 77, was intended to deceive them. Jara, like Ada earlier, may have inadvertently broadcast the message because he did not know how to operate the radio and the intercom. To our knowledge, none of them had ever flown an actual airliner before. At least two callers from the flight reported that the hijackers knew that the passengers were making calls, but did not seem to care. It's quite possible Jara knew the success of the assault on the World Trade Center. He could have learned of this from messages being sent by United Airlines to the cockpit of its transcontinental flights, including Flight 93, warning of cockpit intrusion and telling of the New York attacks. But even without them, he would certainly have understood that the attacks on the World Trade Center would already have unfolded given Flight 93's tardy departure from New York. If Jara did know that the passengers were making calls, it might not have occurred to him that they were certain to learn what had happened in New York thereby defeating his attempts at deception. At least 10 passengers and 2 crew members shared vital information with family, friends, colleagues, or others on the ground. All understood the plane had been hijacked. They said the hijackers wielded knives and claimed to have a bomb. The hijackers were wearing red bandanas, and they forced the passengers to the back of the aircraft. Callers reported that the passengers had been stabbed and that 2 people were lying on the floor of the cabin, injured or dead, possibly the captain and first officer. One caller reported that a flight attendant had been killed. One of the callers from United 93 also reported that he thought the hijackers might possess a gun, but none of the other callers reported the presence of a firearm. One recipient of a call from the aircraft recounted specifically asking her caller whether the hijackers had guns. The pastor replied that he did not see one. No evidence of firearms of their identified remains were found at the aircraft's crash site. And the cockpit voice recorder gives no indication of a gun being fired or mentioned at any time. We believe that if the hijackers had possessed a gun, they would have used it in the flight's last minutes as the passengers fought back. Passengers on 3 flights reported to the hijackers' claim of having a bomb. The FBI told us they found no trace of explosives at the crash sites. One of the passengers who mentioned a bomb expressed the belief that it was not real. Lacking any evidence that the hijackers attempted to smuggle such illegal items past security screening checkpoints, we believe the bombs were probably fake. During at least 5 of the passengers' phone calls, information was shared about the attacks that had occurred earlier that morning at the World Trade Center. 5 calls described the intent of passengers and surviving crew members to revolt against the hijackers. According to one call, they voted on whether to rush the terrorist and attempt to retake the plane. They decided and acted. At 9:57, the passenger assault began. Several passengers had terminated phone calls with loved ones in order to join the revolt. One of the callers ended her message as follows. Everyone's running up to first class. I've got to go. Bye. The cockpit voice recorder captured the sounds of the passenger's assault muffled by the intervening cockpit door. Some family members who listened to the recording report that they can hear the voice of their loved one among the din. We cannot identify whose voices can be heard, but the assault was sustained. In response, Jara immediately began to roll the plane to the left and right, attempting to knock the passengers off balance. At 9:58 and 57 seconds, Jara told another hijacker in the cockpit to block the door. Jara continued to roll the airplane sharply left and right, but the assault continued. At 9:59:52, Jara changed tactics and pitched the nose of the airplane up and down to disrupt the assault. The recorder captured the sounds of loud thumps, crashes, shouts, and breaking glass and plates. At 10:03, Jara stabilized the airplane. 5 seconds later, Jara asked, "Is that it? Shall we finish it off?" The hijacker responded, "No, not yet. When they all come, we finish it off." The sounds of fighting continued outside the cockpit. Again, Jara pitched the nose of the aircraft up and down. At 10 o'clock and 26 seconds, a passenger in the background said, in the cockpit, "If we don't, we'll die." 16 seconds later, a passenger yelled, "Roll it!" Jara stopped the violent maneuvers at about 10:01 and said, "Allah is the greatest, Allah is the greatest." He then asked another hijacker in the cockpit, "Is that it? I mean, shall we put it down?" To which the other replied, "Yes, put it down and pull it down." Passengers continued their assault until 10:02 and 23 seconds. Hijackers said, "Pull it down, pull it down." Hijackers remained at the controls, must have judged the passengers were only seconds from overcoming them. The airplane headed down. The control wheel was turned hard to the right. The airplane rolled onto its back. One of the hijackers began shouting, "Allah is the greatest, Allah is the greatest." With the sounds of the passenger counterattack continuing, the aircraft plowed into an empty field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, at 580 miles per hour, about 20 minutes flying time from Washington, D.C. Jarrah's objective was to crash his airliner into symbols of the American Republic, the Capitol, or the White House. He was defeated by the alerted, unarmed passengers of United 93. That is the report. That's the first 14 pages of the 9/11 Commission report. I wanted to share some of the things I underlined as I read this. And this is not easy to read. I have to admit, I'm crying as I read it. Here's some of the things that I thought were important that I underlined. This comes from page 16. On 9/11, the terrorists turned off the transponders on three of the four hijacked aircraft. With its transponder off, it is possible, though more difficult, to track an aircraft by its primary radar returns. But like transponder data, primary radar returns do not show the aircraft's identity and altitude. Controllers at centers rely so heavily on transponder signals that they usually do not display primary radar returns on their radar scopes. But they can change the configuration of their scopes so they can see primary radar returns. They did this on 9/11 when the transponder signals for three of the four aircraft disappeared. Before 9/11, it was not heard of for a commercial aircraft to deviate slightly from its course, or for an FAA controller to lose radio contact with a pilot for a short period of time. Controller could also briefly lose a commercial aircraft's transponder signal, although this happened much less frequently. However, the simultaneous loss of radio and transponder signal would be a rare and alarming occurrence and would normally indicate a catastrophic system failure or an aircraft crash. In all of these instances, the job of the controller was to reach out to the aircraft, the parent company of the aircraft, and other planes in the vicinity in an attempt to reestablish communications and set the aircraft back on its course. Alarm bells would not start ringing until these efforts, which could take 5 minutes or more, were tried and had failed. That, my friends, is the number one reason why nothing could have been done. Now, they talk about NORAD's mission and structure in here. Page 17, it says, NORAD perceived the dominant threat to be from, at the time, to be from cruise missiles. Other threats were identified during the late 90s, including terrorist use of aircraft as weapons. Exercises were conducted to counter this threat, but they were not based on actual intelligence. In most cases, the main concern was the use of such aircraft to deliver weapons of mass destruction. Interagency collaboration. The FAA and NORAD had established protocols for working together in the event of a hijacking, as they existed on 9/11. The protocols for the FAA to obtain military assistance from NORAD required multiple levels of notification and approval at the highest levels of government. FAA guidance to controllers on hijack procedures assumed that the aircraft pilot would notify the controller via radio or by swapping the transponder code of 7500, universal code for hijack in progress. Controllers would notify their supervisors, who in turn would inform management all the way up to FAA director of the FAA Office of Civil Aviation Security. The hijack was confirmed procedures called for the hijack coordinator on duty to contact the Pentagon's National Military Command Center. Was there really enough time? And the answer is no. As stated previously, they had thought about it, but they really never conceived that the airplane would be the weapon itself of mass destruction. I had read, after 9/11, at that time period, I was reading spy novels. I picked up two. In those two novels, written early 90s and late 80s, planes were used as weapons in those novels. I just happened to pick up two. Different times. It was within months of things, and I just sat there shocked that somebody had actually written about 9/11 years earlier in a fiction, in a novel. It still makes me think, was Bin Laden reading American novels? This were was KSM. Was he the one who read these things? You know, you ponder some of these things as you read on. I have read a good percentage of this book, and I do recommend purchasing it. Again, the 9/11 Commission Report, I've only read through the first few pages. And this has gotten me much farther than I expected in time. I didn't think about how long it would take. I have to apologize for not being able to handle this. And I don't know how anybody who lived through this can, but it's hard. I do want to talk about some of the other things in here. Now, yeah, I do want to remind you that we, the American citizens, did not know who attacked us until almost a week later. Maybe it was longer. I can't remember the exact time we found out. All we knew then was that we were at war. America was angry and mourning and sad. We were tearful and we were raising our fists to the sky, ready to kick ass in return. It was a ways to go yet before we learned about KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the alleged mastermind behind 9/11. Now, this comes from page 145 to 150, and you're going to ask yourself, why am I reading this now? If you've been paying attention to the news, under President Dementia, President Joe Biden, President Dementia, we are going to have a trial for the massive murderous idiocy, the massive jihadi success, which is how they would have deemed it, on 9/11. This mastermind is getting a trial. Will they televise it? I hope not. But let me tell you what we have on him in the 9/11 report. I've read many more things that are not in here over the years. through various articles, various things that have come up since the 9/11 report was written. But this is pretty good. This comes from page 145 to 150 in the 9/11 report. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. No one exemplifies the model of terrorist entrepreneur more clearly than Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the principal architect of the 9/11 attacks. KSM followed a rather torturous path on his to his eventual membership in Al-Qaeda. Highly educated and equally comfortable in a government office or a terrorist safe house, KSM applied his imagination, technical aptitude, and managerial skills to hatching and planning an extraordinary array of terrorist schemes. These ideas included conventional car bombings, political assassination, aircraft bombings, hijacking, reservoir poisoning, and ultimately the use of aircraft as missiles guided by suicide operatives. Like his nephew, Ramzi Youssef, 3 years KSM's junior, KSM grew up in Kuwait but traces his ethnic lineage to the Balochistan region, straddling Iran and Pakistan. He's starting to hear this Iranian connection that Claire will be talking about next week. Raised in a religious family, KSM claimed to have joined the Muslim Brotherhood at age 16. Are you listening? These people, these terrorists, had membership in the Muslim Brotherhood. Osama bin Laden is still revered as a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, even though we know he's dead. He joined the Muslim Brotherhood at age 16 and had become enamored of violent jihad at youth camps. Youth camps? Oh, who ran those youth camps? The Muslim Brotherhood. In 1983, following the graduation from secondary school, KSM left Kuwait to enroll in Chowan College, a small Baptist school in Murfreesboro, North Carolina. After a semester at Chowan, KSM transferred to North Carolina Agricultural Technical State School University in Greensboro, which he attended with Yusuf's brother, another future Al-Qaeda member. KSM earned a degree in mechanical engineering in December of 1986. The year I was supposed to graduate from college. I'm going to take a break, and I'm going to pull Alaskan in, and I've just got to get to my mouse over there. Hello, Alaskan. Is that you?
Hey, how you doing, Paul?
Hi. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah. With all that you're reading, I saw or watched a show last night. It actually was on Tuesday. I had recorded it. It's called 10 Steps to Disaster. It's on the Smithsonian channel, if you get it. And it goes through 10 steps that happened to take place before the 9/11 bombing. And these 10 steps actually occurred over, 11 years or so. They picked it up at the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. And then go through the steps that they had missed, overlooked, or just didn't pay attention to that led to all of this and the success of what the terrorists did. It was a very interesting show, and it took into account all the agencies, the military, the air traffic control, air defense system, and everything as to what happened, what was missed, and how it could have been prevented. I mean, what happened that day during those 4 hours? I think it was 4 hours, 2 hours. You know, is, and what you read in the report is not to be dismissed or anything, but it's a telling backstory of how these guys got away with it to begin with. If you get a chance, if you have the Smithsonian Channel in your TV or whatever, I would highly recommend
watching. One of those, one of those steps that happened. My parents live, they're snowbirds, and they lived around Port St. Lucie. And that is where I believe Muhammad Atta received his airline, his pilot training. There was two pilots that received training there. The trainer notified the FBI that the two people he was training did not want to learn how to land. They disappeared shortly thereafter. And this is, we were not talking. This is the problem that we were having. And it is the original reason why DHS was created, is that agencies were not talking to each other. They were very protective of their information. And they had no easy clearance of, or no easy way to share information without getting several clearances, even with a federal, with a fellow federal officer. They were not allowed to communicate if they were in a different department. And you sit here and you listen to this.
They did cover that aspect of it. Because one of the things that happened at that time that Otto was going through school was that there was an exceptionally high number of Arabs going through flight training in the U.S. at that time period also. And there was not only that happening, but an FBI agent in the Southwest had written a memo to be passed on up the line, and I can't remember if he was FBI or CIA, telling exactly what was going to happen. You know, he had kind of figured it out. You know, like reading your novels. He kind of said that he figures that what they're going to do is fly airplanes. And
I remember reading that.
He was going to send it to you know, he wanted to go up the chain and stuff, and it looked like it got held on the supervisor's desk in the office.
They didn't believe him,
and that was,
is what it came down to. They thought he was,
that was
a nutcase.
Yeah, and that was at least 2 years before.
Yes.
And some of the other things that they had mentioned was the military alert radar and stuff. Because it was right after the Cold War and stuff, they didn't do any upgrades or anything. They just let the radars slide. So, you know, they couldn't spot nothing.
Now, this is another point that younger generation. Our FAA, every air traffic controller person was, they were so stressed out. They were in some ways killing themselves because our air traffic control system was so poor, so unusually poor. I mean, the systems were constantly breaking down. They'd have to change to a different radar system or to a different monitor because things were consistently breaking down and they were not the best. They were not up to date. And this was happening throughout the United States.
The thing was that the radars, you know, especially the military radars, were absolutely blind. They could not find those four aircraft once they turned off their
transponders.
They're transponders. And the military radar couldn't find them. And, you know, that shows you just how vulnerable we were, not only to what happened on 9/11, but had the Russians have known that, they could have flown over here without transponders on their aircraft and got right through. You know, if that radar was looking for a signal from the aircraft.
Well, they knew that at that time because we were doing that with Russia and Russia was doing that with us somewhat because we had it was a switch. You flicked off or it would be the friend or foe transponder. Yes.
Right. And all the Russians had to do was just turn off their transponders and they wouldn't have been seen. You know, that's just the way it was, or, you know, and how far the military had dropped back on their preparedness. So, yeah, I mean, what those guys did on 9/11 was completely outrageous, but how they got away with it was even more outrageous and upsetting than what they actually accomplished. Because we let them do it.
I think the number one thing that we have to take away from this is that we have not learned anything. Even to date.
No.
We have not learned anything about who our enemy is. Now, the majority of people who listen to this show understand what I'm saying. The Sun Tzu told us, if you don't know your enemy, you can't win. You just can't. You might win one battle, but you're going to lose the next because you don't understand your enemy. Great men like... Dr. Stephen Coughlin. He actually is the one who understood and wrote about the threat doctrine of the Muslim Brotherhood. No one else to date has come up with the wisdom that he has shared. And at present, no one is teaching this that I am aware of to our military personnel. And that is scary.
What's his name in the Art of War said that?
Sun Tzu.
You know, and that was about 500 years ago.
It's a good amount of years ago. Yeah. I don't remember the exact year. It's probably closer to a little bit. I sit here shocked when I think about these things and the fact that we've had 20 years to learn who our enemy is and we're doing the opposite. I've got to share a little bit now on that topic and I'm just going to put you on so you can hear, because that's
sure.
a topic I wanted to talk on. Thank you for calling in.
Okay. You bet.
All right. Yeah. This topic that we have not learned anything. I did not know. I didn't think I'd have enough information to go on, but I want to talk about that. We have not learned anything. 10 years ago, Debbie Schlussel wrote an article, which I think is important, and I'm going to share it with you now. Why do I think it's important? This is 10 years ago. Okay. August 30th, 2011. Pew Report. 1/3 of U.S. Muslims support Al-Qaeda. Suicide bombs, 25%, came to the United States under Bush and Obama. Now, I want you to think about that. Those people who came after 9/11, at least a quarter of all those who came in were supporting our enemies. Have we learned our lesson? No. So who is the enemy is what we have to start asking. Who is it that bombed us on 9/11? You know, if you have a hole in your head in the United States, you should at least know who bombed us on 9/11. Well, the answer generally given is Al-Qaeda. Why did Al-Qaeda do this? And you listen to the answers. I've heard a lot. The general answer is they were radical Muslims. Okay. What did they teach that's different than what other Muslims teach? That's an important question. Now, Dr. Stephen Coughlin, he was a major back then when he wrote his first treatise, his master's thesis on this. And as I read that report, I was in utter horror. And I was just beginning to have my eyes opened. Just. I read that report shocked, awed, and all of a sudden I needed to learn more. Did I want to? Well, no. I had to because it had become personal to me. The Muslim Brotherhood had moved and started acting in my neighborhood. I had to wait till it became personal. It doesn't make me out to be a great patriot. It makes me out to be a selfish jerk. But that's what I was. I had to wait till it became personal. And I know that's probably true for many of us. And when you start to realize we have not been learning who the enemy is. Debbie Schlussel wrote this in, again, August 30th, 2011, about the 1/4 of those coming to the States agreed with Al-Qaeda under Bush and Obama. So we didn't learn who our enemy was 10 years ago. Last year, Robert Spencer wrote an article on CARE claiming Muslims are the real victims of 9/11. Really? Really, if that's true. Okay, who were the ones electing to die for their faith on that day? Were they Jews? Were they Christians? Were they Buddhists? They only had one thing in common altogether besides being Al-Qaeda. Besides being Muslim Brotherhood, see, those two things they all pretty much had in common. They were all followers of Islam. But no one's asking, was Islam the answer? Was that the enemy? Most of you are unaware. But President Bush made a statement that forbade intelligence personnel from looking into Islam as the threat. As the enemy. He made a public announcement telling us Islam is not the enemy. Because he did that, intelligence sources were forbidden from looking into Islam as the enemy. How do I know this? Part of my training, intelligence analysis, that was in there. You know, I was shocked when I learned that. A president can make a speech and either intentionally or unintentionally create a policy forbidding looking into what may be the real enemy of the United States. Now, for those of you unaware of the history of our country, Islam was our first enemy as a constitutional republic. That is the very reason why the Marines were created. When they talk about from the halls of Montezuma, our first enemy of the constitutional United States were the Barbary Pirates. There's a book out there called The Six Frigates, the historical recount of that battle. I suggest people that you pick it up and learn a little bit more about the foundation of the United States' encounters with Islam and what happened. I do recommend that book. Wow, I cannot believe I'm this far in and I haven't really talked about this yet. This week, education departments are forbidding teachers to mention Islam in connection with teaching on 9/11. This happened in the state of Virginia. The state of Virginia's education department instructed teachers to avoid teaching about, quote, Muslim extremism on 9/11. My suggestion is don't teach about Muslim extremism. Teach about Islam. And that you must talk about what jihad means by using Sharia, by reading from Reliance of the Traveler, so they understand that's not moderate, that's not extremist, it's Islam. I'll agree with them. Don't teach there's something extremist. There isn't. Start learning that the word extremist is used to define someone who is violent. What if they haven't done anything violent yet? Like Muhammad Atta hadn't done anything that they knew of until he put that plane into the tower. So if you're only going to extreme, I've talked with a few intelligence personnel. I've talked with some federal officers on this term extremism. And when they use it to define violent persons who commit acts of violence, we have a problem. Because extremism means they do something outside the norm. But if their belief structure involves doing something like this, it's a problem because they're not defining things. Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Eric. Yes, you're right. The Six Frigates. Yes, that is the story of wanting jizya. I have been reading and reading. I do recommend telling the truth to your students about jihad. Don't read it from a book. Social studies teachers are informed what jihad is by reading textbooks. The jihad textbooks tell our students, our children of today, that it means struggle. That is a lie from hell. Read what Muslims tell other Muslims about jihad. Read it in Reliance of the Traveler. I don't have time to share that. I don't. But I'm going to tell you, if you are serious and you want to learn more, pick up Reliance of the Traveler. There is so many things happening this week, and I thought I would get to all this news, and I usually overpack. And I want to tell you that we have a it's that Islam does not function alone. It molds with the red green, with communism, and I don't want to forget to say that. I am really down to the wire. So I do want to say who does have it right, which kind of surprised me when I think about it. You know, I've tried to change the things here by to make things better. I've written a joint resolution, which I went and proposed to several members of Congress, both in the Senate and the House, and not one of them was man enough to take it. Not one. Congressional representatives, all of them Republicans, not one of them had the cojones necessary to stand up and take this before Congress, which would have declared this. It would have recognized the Muslim Brotherhood within the United States had declared war on the United States. That's an act of treason, people. It would have shut them down if they had said yes. They'd have, you know, they just want to recognize that. That's all they had to do was recognize that. They didn't have to declare war. All they had to do was recognize it. But we have too many men and women in positions of political power that are cowards. You know who got it right? This week in Egypt, the Egyptian courts ruled against the allowing parole for members of terrorist groups. Their reasoning is based on the fact that the issue is their ideology, which condones and agrees with acts of violence. How come we can't get that right? Now, I'm going to run out of time, but I do want to share that there are some great, outstanding shows here on Blog Talk Radio's Global Patriot Radio Network. Tomorrow we have Dr. Andrew Herod. He's on around 12 noon Eastern time. Saturday night we have Usama Dakdok, and we have Christy Johnson revealing the truth about Islam. Sometime back there in the past. Sunday and Tuesday we have Erica Kafiristan. Come join him. On Monday we have Alan Vito, the Real Radio Man, the Vito Esposito Show. And Wednesday we have Hank Apolli Sports, and I will be back next Thursday with Claire Lopez, an interview you won't soon forget. Thank you for joining us. God bless. And we'll play that beautiful, beautiful song.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see your glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads.
My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. As soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole
sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. Cause we'll put a boot in your ass. It's the American way. Hey!
started shaking her fist, and the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be hell when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining. Of the red, white, and blue. Oh, 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 of the red, white.